मनुपितास्य धर्मस्य संसिद्धिः हेतोर्थम्।
It is therefore concluded that the highest perfection one can achieve by discharging the duties prescribed for one's own occupation according to caste, divisions and orders of life is to please the personality of Godhead. 1:2:17 Shinvatam svakata krishna punya shavana kirtana rijyanta stohya vajrani Viranoti Srihitsatam. So you note that when a word ends with a Y, and the next word starts with an A, so you just Rijyanta. You sort of Rijyanta, so you sort of join the words. You can, but if you were saying just the one word by itself, you would say Riddhi. Shrinvatam svakata krishna punya shravana kirtanaha hridyantasto yabhadrani vidyanoti srihitsatam. Sri Krishna, the personality of Godhead, who is the Paramatma Supersoul in everyone's heart and the benefactor of the truthful devotee, cleanses desire for material enjoyment from the heart of the devotee who has developed the urge to hear his messages, which are in themselves virtuous when properly heard and chanted. 1:2:18 And the same with the V. When a word ends in the V and the next word is A, so you just join. So it'd be, nice to pray use for Bhadrashu. But if you were saying the word by itself, you would say prayeshu. Nasta prayasva bhadrasyu nityam bhagavata sevaya bhagavatyuttama sloke bhakti bhavati naistiki. Nasta prayasva bhadrasyu nityam bhagavata sevaya bhagavatyuttama sloke bhakti bhavati naistiki. By regular attendance in classes on the Bhagavatam and by rendering of service to the pure devotee, all that is troublesome to the heart is almost completely destroyed, and loving service unto the personality of Godhead, who is praised with transcendental songs, is established as an irrevocable fact. 1:2:19 Tada rajastamo bhava karma lova dayaschaye chitta itte inavidhi sattam sadve prasidati. Tada rajastamo bhava karma lobha dayas chaye chitta ite anavidam sitam sadve prasidati. As soon as irrevocable loving service is established in the heart, the effects of nature's modes of passion and ignorance, such as lust, desire and hankering, disappear from the heart, then the devotee is established in goodness and he becomes completely happy. So we're continuing our discussion on chapter 19 of the fourth canto, and we had been hearing how King Prithu was performing 100 horse sacrifices, 100 horse sacrifices. Each sacrifice sacrificing one horse. We understand, of course, that no animals were hurt during that ceremony. That an old horse might be placed into the fire and would come out with a rejuvenated youthful body. It was a great blessing for the horse. And of course, it showed the potency of the mantras and the brahmanas who were performing that ceremony, that they had such potency, and therefore people could have faith in the ceremony. Of course, Lord Vishnu appeared at this sacrifice, which is another indication it's not just an empty ritual, but Lord Vishnu, along with all his associates, appeared. And after that, performing those sacrifices, the lamb began supplying all necessities in abundance. So that is another indication, of course, that the yajñas are being performed properly. So then we heard how when Prithvi Maharaj was performing the last horse sacrifice, Indra, dressed as a sannyasi, stole the sacrificial horse. When Indra saw Prithvi's son pursuing him, he gave up his false dress, left the horse and disappeared, and that was repeated twice. King Prithvi prepared to kill Indra himself for introducing irregular sannyas orders. And so we're up to verse 23. Whatever different forms Indra assumed as a mendicant because of his desire to seize the horse were symbols of atheistic philosophy. So, in Prabhupada's purport, he mentions, of course, that at the present moment, many so-called sannyasis or mendicants have no understanding of God consciousness. And such sannyas was introduced by Indra because of his jealousy of Maharaj Prithvi. And what he introduced is again appearing in the age of Kali. So this was, introduced in a previous age. Satyayuga, is it? Here, I think, I remember. Where are we? Is Satyayuga? Prithvi Maharaj, yeah? So, this is a few yugas back. So, still, the wrong that Indra introduced is being followed in this Kali Yuga. Now, we were discussing, appears in Kali Yuga, this Kali Yuga and other Kali Yugas. So we were discussing the point also that, it's not, it's likely that the system that Prithvi Maharaj, where he set up towns in certain places, which were strategic points, according to his perfect knowledge of the way the earth works, it's possible that there are some remnants of that being followed, in other yugas after him. And here it's confirming, that some things are followed in many yugas. Here something bad is being followed that Indra introduced, so it's not unlikely that some of the good things that were introduced by Prithvi Maharaj are being followed in various yugas as well. Now Prabhupada mentions here that no one can introduce any new system into the Vedic way of life. If one does so out of malice, he is to be known as a basandi or atheist. Sabakandi or Pasandi. Srila Prabhupada mentions that although it is forbidden, there are many Pasandis who coin terms like Dharijanarayan and Swami Narayan. Although not even such demigods as Brahma and Shiva can be equal to Narayan. That's intermission. There's popcorn and jaffas out in the hallway. Vedic society is like that. That you know, it's something which is set as a perfect system. So new things are not introduced. That's one of the dilemmas that people have, you know, with the mainstream religions such as Christianity, Muslim religion, Buddhism, that some very new practices are being introduced, and it sort of rocks the foundation of the various churches that if some of the major fundamental principles, are changed, then you sort of wonder what you're putting faith in if something's, shifting and changing. And then, people tend to wonder that, I'm following such a particular religion at the moment, and in 10 years' time it could be just a whole different thing with all the things I don't believe in, So, it's very, very disturbing. And Vedic society is not like that, though. It's, everything is set, and things cannot be introduced. But this topic of sannyasis. I used to live on an island in Waiheke Island off the coast of Waiheke Island. Are you there? Yeah, okay. Yes. Yeah. I used to do a Sunday feast. Yeah. So I used to hire a hall for $20 in surf. What's that place? Surf something. That's the name of the place. It's a suburb there. It's, there's Palm Beach and there's. Anyway. That might have been later. When were you there?
Right.
Yeah, I was in 91 to 93. I was there. Oh, so it's good to see something is continuing there. In those early days of Waiheke Island, it was a very unusual place because a lot of alternative people moved off the mainland of, from New Zealand and onto this little island, which was just, and it was just a 20-30 minute ferry ride, to the mainland. So it was this bohemian sort of culture. But at the same time, you had very wealthy people, the lawyers and politicians. Sultan of Brunei used to have a very expensive batch there, and Rod Stewart and his wife. They're divorced now, but they used to go there. Rachel Hunter, so there was. But the unusual thing about it was that. People mixed equally. So, whether some people were rich, very, materially successful, or people were just walking around barefoot, they just, it was a very community, you know, it was a very unusual place, it was a nice place to preach. But they used to have their sannyasis, you know, and the sannyasis, and of course people thought that they were very spiritually elevated people. So I remember one in particular, he was all dressed in orange, on Waiheke Island. All his possessions, he had a stick and he had a, you know, a cloth bag tied to the end of it. All his possessions were in there. So, you know, people thought because he had no home, they were only his possessions, he was a sannyasi, and they thought that he was very spiritually elevated. But he wasn't. He was, on the contrary, he was a complete sex maniac, you know. And, you know, again, we were talking about Bhagavan Raj Nish.
Yes.
And then, you know, people tend to think that if someone has, if someone is completely detached from the laws of society or what is...
It says for the group, it says thank really? You for your association.
Oh, thank you.
Sorry.
Wow.
Karina, CJ's wife, made it for us.
Oh, wow.
So we can have it later.
And it's offered? Like,
yes, CJ.
Yeah, it's all offered. Yeah, very good. See, there's a big cake. I was going to say, I'll never get through that myself. See? Oh, that's a... Yeah, that's it.
You know Karina?
Karina, yeah.
CJ.
Initiated.
She's worked at, she was a cook at Gopal's.
Yeah, I think I know that.
You know Karina, CJ?
I probably do.
CJ.
Ah! Chunji's? Oh, yes, CJ. His wife?
Correct.
Oh, gee. Gee, that's a big effort for her because she's not been well.
That's right.
Yeah.
She's part of the rehabilitation project.
Okay. That was very, gee, okay. All right. Okay. Wonderful. Have accepted. We'll have to stop half an hour early so we can get the spoons in the face. So anyway, this so-called sannyasi, you'd often see him lying naked on the beach, and you know. But you know, we won't go into too much detail. But you know, it's but. People accepted him as a very spiritually, you know, elevated person because, you know, the fact that he was, detached. That, you know, he appeared to be detached. No home, you know, no job, no money, no clothes, no bath. What's that? Market vote, that's right. Market vote, yeah. The monkey, the paragra of the monkeys, that's right. That's a good point, yeah. That's exactly right, yeah. But the monkeys are also appear to be great sannyasis, you know, because they just live, you know, in the trees and they have no possessions. And, but, you know, they're always surrounded by many she monkeys. And, yeah, it's just all day. So, these sorts of sannyas, cheating sannyas systems were introduced. But, you know, what always surprises me is how people in vast numbers will actually worship these people as elevated and be cheated by them. anyone else got any horror stories they'd like to share with us?
Everywhere.
Everywhere. En masse, yeah. Yeah.
Like, following politicians or
Yes, that's a fact. Yeah. Yes, they worship our politicians as described in the Bhagavatam. They're also, they're rogues in royal dress. That's how it's described in the Bhagavatam. Rogues in royal dress, yeah.
What do you mean, actors as well?
There's actors, yeah, Hollywood, and Hollywood. Musicians, you know. Bollywood's catching up, you know. They sort of, is it? Yeah, is it? Okay. I must have missed a few episodes, but yeah. Who's that?
Osho.
Osho? Yeah. Yeah. Same person, Osho, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, you know the monkey?
Playboy yoga.
Playboy
yoga. It was like naked yoga, laughing yoga, food yoga. And it's actually making me a little bit upset now. So when I'm teaching, I'm really starting to feel a little bit fired up. So I'm saying more about the soul, that connection to God, that's yoga.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, no, that's right, yeah. You know, for most people, you know, they just have to have the word there, yoga or Ayurvedic. They can be selling anything, you know. But if the word is there somewhere on the label or in the advertisement, oh, you know, it's spiritual, it's something, you know. So these things are quite rampant now, and really, you know, Prabhupada always considered that this Hare Krishna movement was the only thing, the only real refuge of holding back, you know, the corruption and of Kali Yuga, and even where religions, politicians, you know, and in India, you know, the ancient traditions in the temples, where they're actually following properly, a lot of it is imitation of, you know, the standards that we've set in the Hare Krishna movement. Because, you know, it's documented in the Prabhupada Leelamrita, you know, that's a unique part of the history of the world. The Prabhupada was preaching in India, which of all places, you know, practically you could go anywhere in the world in those days, in the 60s and the 70s, and people, if you ask them, you know, where is really the spiritual hub on this planet, people understand India. You know, if you want spiritual instruction, you know, a very high degree, you go to India, you know. And there are many great personalities who acknowledge that all over the world. But even in Prabhupada's time, he found that he couldn't get a foothold, you know, with the Hare Krishna movement, because they were going in a different direction. You know, they were heading more towards, you know, modernization, industrialization, technology, you know, economic development and what have you. He had to go to the West in order to, you know, get a foothold, you know, with the Krishna consciousness movement. Not that the West was, you know, spiritually advanced. They were considered, you know, I think it was recognized also that the West was considered to be, you know, more materialistic and more degraded than most places on, you know, in the world. It was, but so, you know, this Krishna consciousness movement, when Prabhupada established it, he went to the West and he understood that if I can, if the whole world is following, you know, America basically, who are, you know, sort of, everyone wants to follow the Americans, you know, be American and be the, you know, the men want to be the rugged cowboy and, you know, the women want to, you know, they had their role models. But Prabhupada understood if he could get a foothold in Krishna consciousness, then the world would follow them because they're just following America. So, and then when Prabhupada went back to India, they did. You know, they saw or hear these, as Prabhupada called them, his dancing white elephants. And, you know, they were saying, well, this is, you know, this is our culture, you know. And they followed. And then many of the backward trend that was there in India was actually reversed to some degree because of the Hare Krishna movement. That, you know, the Indian people took up. Yes, this is our culture. Again, yes, you know, the Americans are embracing it. Let us also not give it up. Let us embrace. So. And Prabhupada said that in the history books in the future, they will write this, that this Krishna consciousness movement saved this planet Earth in its darkest hour. He said they will put that in the history books, you know. When you have a proper look at the history, they'll put that there. So, but apart from that, you know, the Krishna consciousness movement giving some standard of... you know, the rest of the world, there's all these crazy things going on, and the Krishna consciousness movement is at least giving people a comparison that, well, you know, yes, I agree that, you know, a sadhu should be like this, and they shouldn't be, you know, like the monkey type of renunciate and things like that. So, very important, you know, and like you're doing, you know, yoga. Yourselves, and you know, you come across so many people, see so many different things, and you know, it's an opportunity for you to also establish, you know, here's the real standard, and you know, be careful not to just accept false imitations, which, you know, ineffectual. You have doctors and IT.
And,
Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
But that's just, I mean, in all the yoga teachings, yeah, and all the classes,
yeah,
that's just like
left
out.
Yeah. Completely. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I was,
yeah,
I was thinking, like, just call it stretching class or posture practice or something,
which
is yoga.
Mm.
Because all these things are not yoga.
Yeah. Mm. That's right. You know, there's one thing you notice about Srila Prabhupada's classes. Sometimes Prabhupada, in one sense, had a bit of criticism, and even some of his followers sort of become a little bit disappointed, because when Srila Prabhupada would speak, he wasn't speaking about, you know, the exalted love affairs of the gopis and what have you, but he was speaking about, you know, each, when he would give a lecture, he would explain each and every point in its most basic understanding. And, you know, even sometimes his own followers would be expecting, you know, people left the movement, taking shelter of others to give them, give us something about the gopis and, you know, Krishna's love like this. but Prabhupada understood that, you know, in this day and age, you know, there are no fundamentals. You know, there are no basics. There's not just a basic standard. And you know, above everything, that is what is needed.
They call it yoga nidra.
What is that? Yeah, yes.
Yoga nidra is actually what Mahavishnu.
Yeah.
And they call this yoga nidra. Simply after doing the so-called stretching, you just lie down.
Lie down.
Savasana is a very, it's really very, very important yoga practice.
Yes.
That's fine, but the terms that they're using,
that's right, it is important. He's not denying that it's important, it's just that they're not doing it properly. They're not doing anything properly. Prabhupada said he used to observe himself. He used to go to the yoga places and he would see them, you know, the meditation. He said, I just saw them, they were just simply sleeping, you know.
It's not even shavasana, it's just
what to do, yeah. So, let's see how this was dealt with. So we're in verse 23. Yeah. This term, Dirija Narayan, Swami Narayan, of course, when the impersonalists and Mayavadi sannyasis greet each other, basically they're greeting each other that you are God, you know, so they're addressing each other, you know, Swami Narayan, and he addresses him back as you're also God, you know, Swami. That is the Swami Narayan. And Dirija Narayan means God is, you know, you worship God by serving the poor. Like that. So, because, you know, these concepts, which are, there are an introduction, a false introduction, they're coming from Vivekananda and, you know, the Ramakrishna movement. Dirija Narayan, of course, all the scriptures describe as the Supreme Lord as the husband of the goddess of fortune, Madhava. So, you know, how is it possible that the husband of the goddess of fortune could ever be, you know, poor? Or, you know, the fact is that that individual soul, those individual soul who have become poor and downtrodden, are not the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is always the husband of fortune. And even in Vrindavan, where Krishna is living, you know, in a very simple way, still, the Vrindavan, or Krishna's abode, he was surrounded by hundreds of thousands of Lakshmis, or gopis, or goddesses of fortune. And but the opulence is there, but it's manifest in a very sweet, natural way. So there's some examples. You know, just keep those in mind, Dirija Narayan, Swami Narayan, especially the Dirija Narayan, because you'll come across that most religious institutions, Christianity, and many of the so-called spiritual groups that come out of India, their main focus is actually, you know, doing work to, you know, help alleviate the poor and the suffering. You know, that's a lot of the work is like that. Whereas in the Krishna consciousness movement, the focus is helping people revive their relationship with the husband and the goddess of fortune. So automatically, if someone has some difficulties in the material world, if they're you know, fully protected by the husband and the goddess of fortune, the Supreme Lord, then, you know, there's no question of them ever being poor. Even if they accept, even if they accept the position of having no possessions, there is no, you know, voluntarily. Whether they, you know, even if someone in their spiritual path accepts the position voluntarily of having no possessions, still you cannot call them poor because they're intimately connected with the husband of the goddess of fortune, the Supreme Lord. You know? So in that case, you also can't call them Dirija Narayan. You can't call them Narayan because they're not God, and you can't call them poor because you know, real poverty actually is a lack of knowledge. You know, in the proper Vedic understanding, if someone doesn't have possessions, they're not necessarily poor, because people actually could live very, you know, they can be very happy living a very simple life and really have everything they need on a day-to-day basis. So they've got very few possessions, but they don't consider themselves to be lacking anything. They're just quite happy in a very simple life. Poor is really, in the full sense of the term, is a person who has no proper knowledge. You know, that person is poor. That, you know, they're very unfortunate. You know,
like that. It is that some people are so poor, all they have is money.
Yes, they have money. That's right, yeah.
I was listening to an Encounters program yesterday on Ramakrishna.
Yes.
On Radio National.
Okay.
The ABC presenter made it sound quite a good thing. The Ramakrishna movement was saying that doctors in India are just materialistic. They do medicine because they want to have a fast car and a big house. And this movement was trying to restore the Vedic principles of medicine. So the Indian Hippocratic Oath says you shouldn't eat meat, you shouldn't kill animals. Mm. That's the oath. So it sounded all very feasible and like all would seem to do, and I couldn't really sort of pick a hole in it. I was thinking, well, that's good if they get all their doctors to at least go back to some sort of Vedic practice of medicine.
Yes. No, yeah, that's good.
What's wrong with that particular movement? I mean, how would you shoot that down? How would you say that's not a good thing?
Well, in itself, you know, that's you know, the things that according to the Bhagavad Gita, because we understand everything according to the Bhagavad Gita, according to what Krishna says. A devotee doesn't really have a concept of what's good and bad in the material concept. You know, we call it sort of dry stool, wet stool. You know, it's all stool. You know, if see, the actual problem is that everyone in this world is already you know, intoxicated, as Queen Kunti said, with some sort of material benefits that they may have, or that someone's helping them to have. They become intoxicated with that. It gives them a sense of well-being and what have you. And the real impending problem that at any moment the soul will be snatched out of that body and they can end up in the body of a dog or a worm or this or that is not being addressed. So that's the main problem. And you know, it gives when spiritual movements are engaged in just some temporary material benefit like that, so it's not a bad thing, you know, it's not really a bad thing, it's not sinful. But the general mass of people then never really come to terms with the fact that a spiritual movement can give you something else. We only ever hear of, you know, you really only ever hear of spiritual movements helping the sick, helping the poor, like that. The general mass of people should have an understanding that if you want to understand God, that's probably the something that, I mean, you know, someone doesn't have to belong to a spiritual movement in order to help people, you know, medically, money. It's got really got nothing to do with religion in one sense, you know, except, you know, compassion, that's it. But it's really nothing to do, you know, in it's sort of common decency that every human being should have, you know, that should be there. Let us help one another, and we don't like to see other people suffer. That's really just a normal human quality, which is, you know, in itself is sort of disappearing, but just compassion and for others. So, I mean, you could just approach, you know, most people, and you should be able to get that sort of compassionate help, like that, sharing the facility and helping each other. Not so far we haven't seen a reason in that, you know, why we, that if someone's doing that, we should see that they are spiritually elevated. Right? So if a movement is doing that, should we see that they are spiritually elevated? So if the Ramakrishna movement, you know, if that is there, and if people understand that, you know, the best you'll get really from a spiritual movement is, you know, there are some principles of compassion. I mean, I went to see the Dalai Lama, and I was very disappointed because, not that there was anything bad or anything like that. You know, what he was saying was correct. He was basically saying the same thing, that the main thing I can tell you to teach you is that we should be, you know, helping one another. And I thought to myself, my mother told me that when I was five, you're the Dalai Lama. You know what I mean? It's like I've come to see, you know, a little bit more than that. Like, you know, it's like, does that mean you and my mother are basically on the same platform? Because, you know, I heard that, you know, 50 years ago, and it's, you know, you got something else, a little bit more. I sort of, you know, what makes you the Dalai Lama, you know? You know. You know, but the religious movements are, because the religious movements actually have a lack of knowledge. And really, that's all they can offer. So it's not a bad thing, but it's really just some very common human decency being passed off as elevated spiritual understanding. You know. You go to a religious movement and you should really be able to, can you tell me, can I be educated in, you know, the difference between matter and spirit? Who am I? You know, am I this temporary material body? Do I have an eternal spiritual nature? How do I, you know, revive that lost identity with my spiritual identity? You know, is there a supreme Lord, a supreme intelligent being? How can I understand him? How can I find him? How can I have a relationship with him? You know, how is it that I came into the material world? You know, is it possible to go to the spiritual world? What is the spiritual world like? You would expect to get that sort of information from a spiritual movement. You know, not something your mother can tell you when you're 5 years old. Be a good boy. You know. So, you know, there's a sort of a bit of fraudulence there that, you know, passing something very ordinary off as very elevated spiritual, you know, teachings. That's the problem. It's not really that they're doing anything so wrong. And then to say that what they're doing, this is the ancient Vedic culture. And that's wrong. Yeah, that's right. My mother might hear that.
Sorry.
Yeah. In the same way that, you know, these are the sort of things that were introduced by Indra as well. It appears to be what sannyas is. Indra is introducing this. He's dressed as the most elevated person, but actually his activities have nothing to do with what the real sannyas would be doing. And that's what these movements are doing exactly. In the dress of the most elevated spiritual leaders, their activities are nothing like what actually should be happening. And there is an ulterior motive. As there is an ulterior motive in what Indra did, he, out of envy, he was stopping the Jagun introducing something else in the name of religion, because it's then people will accept it. You know, if you pass something off in the name of religion, people will accept it. If the Ramakrishna passed off the same activities in the name of a political movement, no one would have anything to do with them. And a lot of it is politics and nationalism. If they called themselves the Labour Party, the Liberal Party, and did the same things, no one would accept anything they're doing as spiritual, and most likely they wouldn't have anything to do with them. But if they do these things, whatever they're doing, in the name of religion, they'll get followers all over the world. And this is what Indra did. That if he just, you know, as Indra, went and tried to, you know, oh, I've stolen that horse, you know, don't, you know, harass me. But he understood, well, if I dress as a sannyasi, I can get away with anything. Because there's a natural respect, you know. We saw that, we studied that in, Ashwatthama. Ashwatthama was the unqualified son of a Brahmin, a priest. He had killed Draupadi's five sleeping sons. While they were sleeping, he chopped their heads off and killed them. And then, because he was, Draupadi forgave him on the grounds that he was a Brahmana, someone who should be respected. And you know, showing that, you know, even, you know, just, it's sort of a natural response, even for very intelligent people. It's sort of a natural response that, you know, and of course, you know, where there's that difficulty, you know, many religions are facing is that, you know, one of the difficulties Christianity is facing, of course, is that, you know, there are many, you know, sexual crimes against children. And because they were priests, you know, people were, you know, would go soft on the priests. We also got a taste of it in our movement, you know, and we're not exempt from it, you know, having now, but, you know, there were some instances. But of course, it became quite rampant in Christianity. But, you know, there is that understanding that by the perpetrators that they're likely to get away with murder, with, you know, with what, you know, like that. So really, that's the real crime. That in the name of a spiritual institution, they're not performing spiritual activities, they're not following the Vedas properly. There's a little token, you know. So for instance, if they, if, you know, here they're pushing the medical field, Ayurvedic medicine, you know. So a lot of people give a lot of money for that. You know, sort of thing people give a lot of money for. You know, research and reviving. If they were to say, let us train up, instead of training up so many, you know, doctors and IT technicians and what have you, let's train up some brahmanas who will preach the Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam. How many donations do you think they'll get? None. But what is really needed is people who can actually teach the real import of the Vedas, the essence of the Vedas. But they know people won't get to that. But they don't care, because, you know, they're just, as long as the donations come in and there's a token gesture towards the Vedas. The Vedas are not about the Ayurveda. Ayurveda is the most, you know, it's a secondary, you know, sub sort of a branch of the Vedas. The essence of the Vedas is saving people from the cycle of birth and death and helping them go back to the spiritual world. Now, that is the foremost. And to do that, one has to, as you know, we're doing here, understand the science of the soul's eternal relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You won't find that, which is the essence of the Vedas. So therefore, again, they're misleading people that, you know, of what the real teachings of the Vedas are about, that if you want to help people, you help them with, if you want to help people through the Vedas, you help them through the Ayurveda. But the Vedas don't say that. You know, the Vedas say, you know, if you want to help people through the Vedas, you help them, you know, attain liberation, you know, from the material body. That's the real source of all their sufferings, like that. So they're misguiding people as to what is the purpose of the Vedas, what is the teaching of the Vedas. It's that which is, you know, the problem. And as Indra was really presenting a token gesture of being a follower of the Vedas as an outward dress to satisfy his ulterior motive, this is actually, if you look deeply, you'll see that that's exactly what they're doing. There's a token gesture as an external dress of, you know, following the Vedas. And really, there is a very deep and, you know, sinful, in many cases, you know, motivation of, behind, you know, what they're doing. That's the problem.
Interesting, because you're talking, I was just thinking about, because we came from kind of like the training in Ishtanga, yoga, and then Steve had, and actually I had a bit of like, shamans that had hypnotic performance. And so we've kind of been in places where there's been like, you know, people that are supposed to be leaders and you're coming. And just been their total manipulation of females.
Yeah.
And they're very, like, I mean, like the shamanic teacher, he was Swami Muktananda's direct disciple. Even Swami Muktananda had a thing where he was with the females. Then, you know, I trusted this shamanic teacher so much for so many years. And then was quite shocked by something that started to happen. And then all that's left at the end of the day is bhakti.
So we've got to see firsthand.
Yeah, yeah. Even so, like that age, and even in the bhakti movement, it's still very vigilant, but it really is the complete.
There's an external dress which hides, you know, a materialistic motivation. And, you know, that external dress is, you know, giving the appearance of spiritual elevation and, you know, being the perfectional follower or representative of, you know, the Vedas, but it's done for some just very materialistic, you know, hidden motivation. So, yes, that's right. And that's your disciple, maybe. That's right.
They do.
They do. Yeah. They believe. Yeah.
And they can come up. Like I met a lama who spent a lot of time in India and came to Australia. And I attended one of his meditation classes. And after he took us on a guided meditation, he started channeling something around me. And I had just come back from Greece and I went to a specific island. And he said, I can see Corfu around you. And it was something that no one would ever have known. So they can be quite...
Oh, they may have some, yeah, they may have some. Yeah.
It looks like magic.
Yes, that's right.
To me, I've met a lot of people who have that. And so there's so many people who are seekers. Easy then to bamboozle people who are searching.
And you know, they do take advantage of that the general mass of people, especially in this day and age, they have no concept of God, you know, no real concept. So if someone does just a little something out of the ordinary, you know, some intuition, a little bit of clairvoyance, or, you know, make something appear, that person can be accepted as God, you know, just like that. And, you know, despite all the corruption in their life or what have you, just a couple of little magic tricks, that's enough.
It's true. Well, I mean, I'm aware of it. But on another side, think about Mother Teresa, who used to do a lot of
Father Teresa.
She just talked about doing welfare and going and really helping people. She didn't talk about religion in any way. What is their destiny in?
Well, you know, her position is like this, that in essence, because the religious institutions are not pleasing the Supreme Lord by, you know, the way they're serving God, by helping people to become God conscious and aware of the Supreme Lord, and you know, therefore, in many ways, religious institutions are even encouraging sinful activities. You know, I mean, the four pillars of sinful activities are illicit sex, gambling, intoxication. So what happens is, because the religious institutions in general are failing the mass of people, people are suffering. They're being encouraged in sinful activities and in godlessness, even by the religions, and therefore people are suffering, and they're going without food and shelter and so many things. And therefore, you know, from her perspective, that while the religious institutions are failing in their activities, and while the politicians are failing and sitting around their tables and, you know, trying to discuss, what they're going to do, people are just going hungry. So her thing was, so while they're all just, you know, doing useless things, there's no benefit to anyone, you know, at least let me give someone something to eat. Because they can't wait for the religions to get their act together, and they can't wait for, you know, the politicians to get their act together, and they can't wait for the wars to stop. So in the meantime, they need something to eat, so let me feed them. So, you know, that's okay. There was no time. She understood. There's no time. You know, these people are hungry now. Someone has to feed them.
She didn't even give them
the salad. Well, that's, you know. She doesn't have, if she had, some proper guidance, then, you know, that probably, that could be very easily remedied. But, you know, it was sort of just, you know, the world is failing these people, they're hungry, they're sleeping out in the cold, just, you know, for goodness sake, you know, let us give them.
And how is this by going to heavenly planets, is that it?
Yeah, I mean, she was, you know, definitely an extraordinarily compassionate person. You know, it appears that, you know, she appears to be someone who sincerely wanted to serve God, but just, you know, not exactly sure how, because, as you said, her religious institutions and leaders had failed her and the world. So because of her sincerity, then, you know, she may get the opportunity to, you know, take, you know, her next birth somewhere where that sincerity will be rewarded with proper instruction and guidance and association. If the sincerity is there, Krishna will, you know, give the opportunity.
Because according to Bhagavad Gita, to be born in a devotee family, you have to be a devotee.
Well, she was a devotee. She was praying to God. She's praying that's bhakti. That's vandanam. She's a devotee.
Did she say that people don't have the time when people are present? Did she?
Yes.
That, you know, nothing's changing, so let me at least feed them.
Yeah, that was her, you know. These people need to be fed. You know, everyone else is failing them. You know, by the time you get your act together, which would be never, they'll just go hungry and let me feed them. You know, so, you know, we're talking about, we're not saying that everyone who's a Christian or everyone that's in the Ramakrishna movement or what have you is a charlatan. There are sincere people who are being cheated by, you know, religious and spiritual movements. So we're not saying that everyone who's a Christian or a Muslim or, you know, in the Ramakrishna movement or even a Mayavadi or, you know, a bogus yogi or what have you is a rascal. But there's many innocent people who are being misled. If they have sincerity, then that will ultimately, you know, that will be fulfilled by the super soul within the heart. But what we're discussing here is, especially when people take the role of leaders and misguide, you know, leaders and you know, religious institutions, where there is, you know, an external dress of spiritual advancement and presenting some Vedic teachings or the teachings of Jesus. The teachings of Jesus are also Vedic. The teachings of Muhammad are also Vedic. It's the same knowledge. If you actually look at the essential teachings of Jesus and Muhammad, it is Vedic teaching. It is the same teaching, the same essential teaching. There's no difference. So, but there are teachers within the Christianity, within the Muslim religion, the Ramakrishna, this one and that one, who are presenting the proper teachings fraudulently. And that's, you know, the sort of thing we're studying here with Indra. At that.
Can I have a question about, yes, people take on that role and they can be misguided and self-aware.
Yes.
Really. What about, my question is about plants and plant medicines, and they also call them teachers.
Plant, they call plants teachers?
Like
mushrooms.
Well,
peyote.
What's the name of that? Because that's like a, something from nature that opens up.
You've been reading Don Juan's Adventures, you know, the Mexican.
I heard someone that told me a little bit about that. I'm just wondering,
yeah,
what your opinion is about that, and if this is like a natural plant that opens up the pineal gland and then takes you, well, appears to take you straight to the source.
There are many, you know, gods and goddesses and demigods, and, you know, this is what we, you know, apsaras and kanaras and kimpurushas, and, you know, these persons exist, and they're. But within plant, there are presiding deities over everything. There are 33 million different demigods. Some of them preside over plants, as what you're saying. So people sometimes worship those presiding deities of those plants, and they accept them as a preceptor or someone that they're learning from how to derive the benefit. Just like one may worship a Dhanvantari to get the medical knowledge. Because he's not necessarily a demigod, but incarnation. But there are also, there are demigods, and one may worship those different demigods in order to get specific knowledge in healing, medicine, yes, like that. So, for instance, I've heard, I'm not sure where the quote comes from, but that Ravi Shankar, worshipped Mother Sarasvati over 7 lifetimes in order to play the sitar as he did, so everything has presiding deities. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that if one worships demigods, one will go to the planet of those demigods, one will live amongst those demigods.
That's temporary, yeah.
It is temporary, that's the problem, is that you can tap into the worship of any one of the 33 million different demigods, and by doing so, that person may actually be awarded the status of that demigod. That if they just develop, they actually literally can take birth as Indra, as that presiding demigod of this plant or this art, what have you. You can actually so you begin by worshipping, and you can actually become that demigod, in one lifetime. But when the results of your piety and that particular desire is fulfilled, we come back down, to the earth planet. And again, so it's a very risky business, because it's said that every living entity, when they first come to the material universe, they come as a Brahma. When you first come to the material world, your first position is Brahma.
Where does it say that?
I think it's in the 11th canto somewhere. I've heard it. I think it's mentioned. Has anyone seen that written? Yeah.
Somewhere it said you come as a human first, and then you fall down.
But I think I've seen it written somewhere in the 11th canon, not necessarily in the translations, but in the purports. But I've also heard it. I'd heard it, but then I did see a reference that I don't mind quoting it now. But I can't remember. I'm pretty sure it's 11th canon. But the point is that. That means how risky it is. Because, if that's your starting position, then you look at, the dogs walking down the street and think, boy, you've really, come a long way down from, Satyaloka, haven't you? You see the cats and the worms and the lice and, you think, gee, all the living entities. It's risky to, if an opportunity comes up, it could be billions of births. You take birth amongst the demigods, and then you're following one. Basically, it's a process of there's some material desire, and it could be to go here, to go there. But the process of following material desires and material world will take you from one birth to another, one body to another. It's a very risky business.
If you worship the plants like that, could you become the plant?
You can also become the plant, yeah.
And they have like specific intelligences, like
a
mushroom has one particular teacher.
I don't know if I'd
want to
be a mushroom,
though. Yeah. How's that? Yeah.
At any moment you could discard yourself.
Can you imagine?
That's what will happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're saying, is it risky because...
Yeah. The riskiness is that it's still worshipping one particular department, like as you said with Aravati, you become a fantastic musician, but then eventually once that's accomplished, then you start again.
That's right.
But you're not really getting anywhere.
You're not really getting anywhere, and then you've got to... Then the process is that whatever your next desire is, and activities, that will take you to your next body. And then when you finish that, what your next desire is will take you to the next body. And that goes on the millions and billions of births. And somewhere, let's take it in the human form of life. So how many humans on this in this planet now? Is about 6, 8?
7 billion
humans. Of those 7 billion, we know that there are, you know, so many cheating religions and, you know, leaders. And most people accept religion as just a process of helping people be better situated to fulfill their material desires. So, you know, this person, you know, is sick and they're not able to fulfill their material desires very well. Let's give them some Ayurvedic medicine and, you know, like that. So we're sort of helping them, you know, into the next body, and, you know, that's religion. Most people are not even interested in religion, they're just interested, most people are interested in, you know, simple activity, most people just want to get as much intoxication, sex life, you know, gambling, meat eating, you know, eat, drink, and be merry before they die, they want to do that as much as they can. Those people that are following religion don't actually follow it, some of them actually, just doing very materialistic activities. So amongst the, nearly 7 billion people, there's, you know, a handful, you know, there's a few humans that have a desire, let me finish the cycle of birth and death in this lifetime and go back to the spiritual world. Now, those few handfuls have come from, you know, they've been through all the different species of life that precede the human form of life. There are 8,400,000 species, according to the Vedas. 400,000 of those species are human, so 8 million different species. So, so many births in each of the different species gradually come to the human form of life, and then even getting the human form of life, only a handful of them may actually take the opportunity that only exists as a human to solve that problem. Now, to miss that opportunity is very risky. Very, very risky. The odds, you know, if you're a gambling person, what is that? That is like, you know, 7 billion to 1 that, you know, after, you know, worshipping the particular demigoddess of this plant, I either become a demigod or I become the plant, or have you. No, but when that's finished, there's about 7 billion to 1 that I may end up with a desire to, you know, in a human form of life somewhere, because if you go down in the plant life, if you go down to the plant life, you generally have to then work your way up, you know, to the human form of life. Yeah, it's quite a lot. Yeah. Not always. Sometimes a sinful person can take, you know, a few births in the lower species as a specific punishment and then go back to the human form of life where they're punished again and then like that, you know. But sometimes, you know, generally people are particularly sinful get cast down, they do have to go through each species, you know, to come back.
But
so it's very risky.
It could also be called purified, isn't it? They go back to be purified.
They get purified, yeah. Purified means you just come back to where you are now.
Go on.
They can wander off, you know, so even the opportunity comes, there's no guarantee that one will take it. So even if one is given a human birth and the association with, you know, spiritually minded people that cultivate that desire that we may have forgotten, so we haven't got it, then that association is, you know, pushing us in the right direction. Still, we might not take it.
How, like,
so it's very risky.
How you could be so sincerely devoted to the Lord, sincerely desiring the Lord, that you
That's right. It is, yes. And that's a good fear to have. You know, that to understand the riskiness of it, you know. Therefore, what Indra is doing is very dangerous because, you know, misleading humans who have, you know, that's a rare birth. Human birth is extremely rare if you consider the numbers. Very rare birth. Amongst humans, to be, you know, to elevate yourself gradually to that consciousness where you want spiritual knowledge and spiritual activity and, you know, eternal life and stop, that is, rare even amongst the rare humans. So, you do a bit of number crunching and it's not worth it. You just wouldn't do it. You know, it's like train surfing. You know, there are some things that you could probably get away with it. I mean, I used to do it all the time, but you know, I wouldn't do it now. Now I understand. But, you know, they had different trains in those days, you know, the old red ones, you could hang on to they had the rails and you could open and shut the doors yourself, you know, the windows, climbing in and out the window. But, yeah, but these days, you know, there's nothing to hang on to, but you wouldn't do it. So the odds are reduced, you know. But, you know, say you think to yourself, will I go train surfing or not? And you look at all the danger of it and the odds are falling off and everything, and you just, you know, you say to yourself, no, no. This is more dangerous, you know. This is more dangerous. You, if you become like a little mushroom, right? One day, some big, you know, antelope or a moose is going to come along and bite your head off, and that's the end of your little, you know, your magic fairy tale.
Yes.
That's right. There are benefits. Yeah. Yeah.
A demigod of Gaia, you know, as there is, I think, Maya, who is creating this illusion. They all have their departments.
There are benefits and specific excellences in every species of life. But what we're not considering here is that our eternal spiritual body incorporates all of those excellences, and you never have to give it up. There's no danger there. And apart from all the excellences put together, there are aspects of having a spiritual body which are not possible in any material form. So, and it's because the religious and spiritual movements are not giving that knowledge that people are instead wanting something inferior. You see? And therefore they're doing people a great disservice. Because as soon as people understand, oh, I could have a spiritual body, which is eternal, all the senses are interchangeable, you know, all the excellences, you know, of each species of life, the senses, you know, are extremely sharp and powerful. And it is just, a minute fraction of, you know, what the spiritual body, you know, all the senses are fully enlivened, fully spiritually enlivened. It's because we are deprived of that knowledge that we're saying, well, you know, give me something inferior, you know. And therefore, Prabhupada gives the example that For instance, you know, if a child is eating dirt, and you know, the mother and the father come out and they think, well, you know, the child's eating dirt, so they give the child some mango, and then the child would eat something like that, and then they just think, well, the child just naturally doesn't want to eat the dirt because they're getting the nice mango and like that. It's because we're not, the spiritual institutions are not giving the higher taste, because they don't know what it is, because they're cheaters. That's the problem. You can ask them the questions and they can't give the answers. That's why Prabhupada says, Dirija Narayan. There's no such thing as, God is not a poor man. This is their highest philosophical understanding, that God has become a poor man. If you want to know God, the best you'll ever get is to feed a poor person. That's as close as you'll get to God. That's not God. You know, if you want to know God, He is the husband of the goddess of fortune. So, you know, it's because they can't give proper knowledge that we may want something very inferior and very dangerous. You know, that. Yes. Well, all of those paths are mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita. As I said, we always, you know, derive our understanding from the standard of knowledge there in the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says that there are many different forms of jagya or sacrifice, and, you know, all of those different paths are mentioned. All of them are purifying in that they destroy sinful reactions, and all of them gradually lead a person to a very nectarian, you know, existence, ultimately to a spiritual platform. So, you know, those persons, they're performing activities which is destroying karma, which may not, if they're doing it properly, is not generating bad karma, although it may be generating some, you know, piety. The result of performing karma yoga or performing good works is that one can go to the heavenly planets. The result of cultivating knowledge and renunciation, as it, like a sannyas, is that one develops the knowledge of the difference between matter and spirit, and detachment from the world. And the result of practicing Astanga Yoga is that one gradually develops the mystic cities, Asta City, eight different mystic perfections, you know, to some degree it's possible in this age, and may also come to understand the super soul, you know, Vishnu, like that. And the result of bhakti is that one develops pure love of God and can realize Bhagavan, or the personality of God. So they all.
And so from the Ashtanga Yoga, I mean, you know, if you're like just completely absorbed, you could make it to Vaikuntha Loka, but very difficult in this age, if you could realize Vishnu.
In this day and age, practically speaking, except for maybe, you know, literally just a few that you could count on your fingers, rare souls, it is not possible to make progress in those other paths in this day and age. There may be a few rare exceptions. That is possible. But they may be persons who are almost left over from a previous era, who are almost nearing perfection and just continuing on. You know, but you wouldn't want to be at the bottom of the rung and then just starting in Kali Yuga. The odds are stacked against you. So, no. So, you know, therefore, it's dangerous, you know, it's dangerous. Yeah.
That's what I understood. I just wanted to get your perception.
Yeah, that's right.
Someone who has just come to the human form.
Yes.
to all those eight species, and it is his first, say it's his first human form, and if he,
yes.
he does, if he's doing super activities like what's outside, if he will come back down, or will he get another way?
Well, there are considered three different species that, you know, ones coming up, they come to the, as a cow, they then can take birth in the human species, somewhat, you know, with an attraction to Satguna or the mode of goodness. They may come up through the tiger sort of species and may have, you know, an attraction to the Rajaguna, or they may come up through the monkey species, such as Darwin, and have an attraction through the Tamaguna, you know, like that. So,
yeah.
It's interesting what you said about monkeys in Vrindavan, just being atheist in spirit. I think they've been Vrindavan a long time ago.
Yeah, that's the benefit of the Holy Dharma.
So the monkey humans
would
definitely
follow. So look, because Prabhupada mentions in the Bhagavatam that humans, for instance, who may have come up through, say, monkeys, or, you know, and they're very, you know, still a strong, you know, attraction to Tamaguna. They may live in the, you know, as natives, you know, in the jungles, so somewhat tribal, you know, not particularly civilized. Civilization, according to the Vedas, is that they understand how to grow grains, as Krishna says. You know, they actually, you know, Krishna says from Jagya, you know, you perform Jagya and you get grain. So, you know, according to the Vedas, civilization, they should be able to cultivate the fields, you know, rather than killing something. You know, I'm getting a bit hungry, I'm going to kill something and, you know, rip its brains out and eat it, you know. You know, civilization, let's throw a few seeds in the ground, we'll let the weed come up, we'll till it like that, and we'll feed the animals as well. So, you know, there may be that sort of, they can take birth in human species like that. There are 400,000 different species of human life, and for them they may be killing and doing things which we may consider sinful. So they have their intoxications, and, you know, they eat meat and do things like that. They don't necessarily get the same reaction, karmic reaction, that we're getting, that a civilized person, you see. Because it's expected that they're, you know, it's not necessarily, they don't get the same karma, because it's almost expected that that is, they're sort of, you know, just come from animal life, they're in the human species, there's going to be a lot of uncivilized behavior. To just give them full karma for that, you know, is, means that there's no chance of elevating, you know. So, you know, there's some concessions that, you know, there's, but even in the most, you know, sort of, you know, primitive sort of tribal, you know, life, there are, you know, taboos, things that they can and can't do. And for everything that they follow, where there's some control of the mind and senses and trying to interact with the society according to the codes of what's right and wrong, gives them some benefit which they can elevate them like that, you know.
So the ones that common people outside definitely will fall down from what?
Yes, for civilized people to, you know, who are well aware of what's right and wrong and who have, you know, much better opportunity, you know, like if there are no choices. I mean, if you don't have a choice to, if you're born in a situation, there's no choice of agriculture, there's no knowledge of it, there's no history of it, there's no room for it, then you can't punish someone for not being, you know, doing it. But if you're born in a civilization which is, you know, the like we are, and there's so much agriculture, and then you decide you're going to jump over the fence and, you know, kill a sheep and, you know, cook it up on the spot, you know, you've got problems. What's that? That's right. You know, they don't have they don't really have the facility, the leadership, or the opportunity to practice a civilized life. They're really, you know. Yeah, that, you know, like they only, if you take birth in some of the Arctic regions, the only thing you can do is go out and kill a polar bear or a seal, or, you know, you can't put a little garden out there. So they're not going to get the karmic reaction, because they're born, there's only one facility, so it's not necessarily sinful for them to follow the only option to eat. You see what I mean? So you know, Krishna is, you know, not cruel or, you know, playing tricks on people. You know, if you eat fish, you'll be punished in this way, and then he makes you take birth with, you know, in such a place where the only option, the only food available is fish. Gotcha. You know, what do they call that? Entrapment. So, you know, Krishna is not one of those entrapment sort of gods. Yeah, because you know, there was a question asked by Parikit Maharaj to Sukadeva Goswami. He asked that we see that Lord Shiva is like the ultimate sannyasi. He lives under a bale tree. He doesn't construct a home for himself. You know, he doesn't wear proper clothing. He covers himself with ash. He sort of has no real possessions. Very austere. But those who worship him become very opulent and become very wealthy. You know, so a lot of people like to worship Shiva. You know. Previously, people would worship the Shalagram Shila. And mostly these days, you know, they worship Shiva and the Shivalinga. And whereas Krishna is the husband and the goddess of fortune. And when people worship Krishna, sometimes they seem to be going without. And, you know, what is the cause of this apparent contradiction? So Sukadeva Goswami said, actually, your grandfather, Yudhisthira Maharaj, once asked that same question to Narada Muni. Yeah, I think, yeah. And he said that, what was it, Krishna?
Krishna gives what is good.
Yeah, that Krishna's policy is that when he shows special mercy to someone, he takes everything off them.
You know. He gives whatever is suitable for the devotional.
Yes.
That's it.
Yeah.
He takes it away, but he gives up.
Yeah.
And so then you only depend on him.
So, you know, whereas Lord Shiva may give material opulence, even if that becomes the downfall in spiritual life, Lord Krishna will give or take away always in order to encourage you in your spiritual life. So sometimes, you know, a devotee may, they want to make spiritual advancement, but they have been bewildered by their material opulence, and therefore Krishna removes that obstacle. And they have no other recourse except to surrender to Krishna. So, You know, that can happen.
Yeah. I can do that in relative terms to say our lifetime here about that and then you could go from here.
But if a devotee uses their opulence, a devotee can have all opulence and still be a kinshana or a person who has no possessions. Prabhupada was such a person. Prabhupada was a kinshana, means he had no possessions. And yet, he had temples all over the world. Vehicles, millions of dollars. But he considered every penny, every paisa was Krishna's and was meant for Krishna's service, to help people to understand God, understand they can go back to the spiritual world and live in their eternal spiritual form. Every penny, every temple, every bit of opulence in this movement was meant for that purpose. Therefore, he had no possessions whatsoever. He was a kinshana. In the beginning, Prabhupada said he was trying to earn opulence. He was trying to develop his business. His plan was, if I build my business up enough, I may be able to fund setting up the movement as my guru had ordered. But Prabhupada revealed in a lecture that Krishna took it all away from him. Every time he just kept smashing it down till he had nothing. He had no family, he had no money. The movement of his spiritual master, Christ, he had nothing. He was just by himself with nothing, nowhere to live, no money, his clothes on his back. And he understood that he was thinking, I'm trying to amass some facility, and Krishna's saying, you depend on me because I have everything you need, to start this movement. What you're trying to, that's not going to do it. You actually need me and I have everything you need. So give up this pursuit. So Prabhupada did. And then he just completely depended on what Krishna provided, not what I'm going to provide for my business. What Krishna provides, that will be my only possessions and facility to start this movement. And then the movement took off like that. So, Krishna can take away, but as Prabhupada says, but when that same opulence is used in Krishna's service, he will give you unlimited opulence back, even in the same lifetime. So one doesn't have to be fearful that, Krishna's going to be really merciful to me. Oh, God, he's going to take the lot, If we have something and we just consider it belongs to Krishna, let me use it for Krishna, then, Krishna will reward that by giving you unlimited more, facility. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So let's move forward. So, it's a good conversation in the sense that we got, because we are discussing, what is real religious principles, what is the real purpose of, religious leaders, sannyasis, spiritual teachers, and what are all the different types of cheating religions, and the danger, of course, if one does get cheated, one will end up in the cycle of birth and death. It's a very dangerous thing. And it's a relevant discussion in that sense, that we understand the importance of what happens, when things go wrong by being cheated in religion, and the benefits when we fully understand, we have a proper religious guide. So let's see how this is was handled. Just one more. What's that?
That is not relevant to us. What happens to him that he doesn't get any punishments? Or, it's only in that loka that our other Gita which tells them.
I'm always fascinated. You're waiting with bated breath for Indra to get some punishment. But, look. It sort of, it gets to you, doesn't it? You know, it's there's a reason. There's a very important reason why, you know, there's some leniency towards Indra, and it's actually in this chapter. So that's, yeah. He is an example. He's also put in that position by Krishna. We're going to look at that. There's a very good understanding. So, it is part of this chapter.
And all demons are envious of Indra, basically. The target is always Indra.
Yes, yes. He needs some protection from them as well. So, verses 24-25. In this way, Indra, in order to steal the horse from King Prithu's sacrifice, adopted several orders of sannyas. Some sannyasis go naked, as I was mentioned, why he on. And sometimes they wear red garments and pass under the name of Kapalika. These are simply symbolic representations of their sinful activities. These so-called sannyasis are very much appreciated by sinful men because they are all godless atheists and very expert in putting forward arguments and reasons to support their case. They're very expert. We must know, however, that they are only passing as adherents of religion and are not so in fact. Unfortunately, bewildered persons accept them as religious, and being attracted to them, they spoil their life. So, here it describes in this verse that actually in Kali Yuga, sannyas is somewhat forbidden. And that's because, you know, there are so many cheating sannyasis who exploit this order. It doesn't mean, though, that if someone can actually follow sannyas properly, then they're not forbidden. But generally, sannyas is forbidden otherwise. Maharaj Prithu, who was celebrated as very powerful, immediately took up his bow and arrows and prepared to kill Indra himself because Indra had introduced such irregular sannyas orders. So he was a king, of course. Prithu, it was his duty to, you know, cut down such persons. When the priests and all the others saw Maharaj Prithu very angry and prepared to kill Indra, they requested him, "O great soul, do not kill him, for only sacrificial animals can be killed in a sacrifice. Such are the directions given by Shastra." Now, especially Indra, you know, how could Indra be killed when he's actually worshipped in the Yajna and accepted as part and parcel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead? Dear King, Indra's powers are already reduced due to his attempt to impede the execution of your sacrifice. We shall call him by Vedic mantras, which were never used before, and certainly he will come. Thus, by the power of our mantra, we will cast him into the fire because he is your enemy. So by the chanting, Prabhupada mentions that you know, the priests who can chant such powerful mantras are no longer present. My dear Vidura, after giving the king this advice, the priest who had been engaged in performing the sacrifice called for Indra, the king of heaven, in a mood of great anger. When they were just ready to put the oblation in the fire, Lord Brahma appeared on the scene and forbade them to start the sacrifice. So it appears that they, saying here, when they were just ready to put the oblation in the fire, Lord Brahma appeared on the scene and forbade them to start the sacrifice. It appears that they lit another sacrificial fire for the purpose of killing Indra. My dear sacrificial performers, you cannot kill Indra, the king of heaven. It is not your duty. You should know that Indra is as good as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Indeed, he is one of the most powerful assistants of the Personality of Godhead. You are trying to satisfy all the demigods by the performance of this jagya, but you should know that all these demigods are but parts and parcels of Indra, the king of heaven. How then can you kill him in this great sacrifice? So we see here that Indra is a key figure amongst the demigods, you know. And just as, you know, the king has many ministers who, in effect, are part and parcel of the king. They represent the king and his powers. All the other demigods are representing Indra and his, you know, position as the king of heaven. In order to make trouble and impede the performance of King Prithu's great sacrifice, King Indra has adopted some means that in the future will destroy the clear path of religious life. I draw your attention to this fact. If you oppose him any further, he will further misuse his power and introduce many other irreligious systems. Let there be only 99 sacrificial performances for Maharaj Prithu, Lord Brahma concluded. Lord Brahma then turned towards Maharaj Prithu and informed him that since he was thoroughly aware of the path of liberation, what was the use of performing more sacrifices? So we see here that King Indra was envious of Prithu Maharaj. Indra had performed 100 of these particular type of sacrifices, and that is the merit that allowed him to take the position of King Indra in his next life. So he was envious of King Prithu that, you know, this would actually give him equal merit, that he would he may take my position. So he wanted to stop him. So he was envious.
But again, did he know that King Prithu actually is Ashaktaneshya, or is an empowered incarnation of Krishna, who is actually higher than Indra? Is not really. Doesn't that make him? And why should he be envious of Prithu? Prithu is anywhere higher than him. Or is it just designed for us to?
Well, here we're seeing that, you know, Indra is being referred to also as Prabhupada mentions in the previous purport. In verse 27, Indra is actually worshipped as part and parcel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Indra, you know, Indra is worshipped as a very important part and parcel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And I guess to him, you know, Prithu Maharaj is also worshipped as a very important part and parcel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. From our understanding, because we're studying the Bhagavatam, we can understand that King Prithu, you know, as the Shaktivesh avatar, is already more elevated than Indra, but that doesn't appear to be Indra's understanding. So actually there was a great competition, as mentioned in the purport to verse 32. There was a great competition, and King Indra, to satisfy his senses, began to invent so many irreligious systems to obstruct King Preeti. To stop these irreligious inventions, Brahma personally appeared in the sacrificial arena. As far as Maharaj Preeti was concerned, he was a great devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, it was not necessary for him to perform the prescribed Vedic ritualistic ceremonies. Such ceremonies are known as karma, and there is no need for a devotee in the transcendental position to execute them. As the ideal king, however, it was King Preeti's duty to perform sacrifices. A compromise was therefore to be worked out. By the blessings of Lord Brahma, King Preeti would become more famous than King Indra. Thus Preeti's determination to perform 100 sacrifices was indirectly fulfilled by the blessings of Lord Brahma. Preeti's position is that as a devotee, he doesn't have to perform activities, material activities, which are very purifying, but they're mentioned in the scriptures that elevate one gradually to the position of a transcendentalist. He was already a transcendentalist. He was more than a transcendentalist because he was not just a transcendentalist, but he was not just someone who was detached from the world and realized that he was a spirit soul, but he was had a confidential serving relationship with the Supreme Lord. So he's very elevated. The purification processes in the Vedas, the various rituals, they're stepping stones on the way to that perfection. So there's no need for him to, you know, perform them. At the same time, because he's the king, it was his duty to perform them. Because everyone is, he's teaching all his subjects, you know, how to perform them, because they need to perform them. Therefore, he's got to engage them in these purificatory activities. But he performs them, and that way he engages all his kingdom, you know, in contributing to, you know, these great yajnas. So he had to perform them, but not for his personal advancement. Brahma basically has offered him the results that one may attain by performing them, even without performing them. So there's a compromise. So he's saying, don't bother doing the yajna. You know, there are some benefits. Take those benefits anyway by my blessing and don't perform the yajna. And that'll stop Indra. So, let there be good fortune to both of you, for you and King Indra are both part and parcel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, you should not be angry with King Indra, who is non-different from you. Non-different, you know, in the sense that you're both a spirit soul who are part and parcel of the Lord, not that you're the same person. Do not be agitated and anxious because your sacrifices have not been properly executed due to providential impediments. Kindly take my words with great respect. We should always remember that if something happens by providential arrangement, we should not be very sorry. The more we try to rectify such reversals, the more we enter into the darkest region of materialistic thought. So this is a very interesting and very important statement by Brahma. In the purport, Prabhupada explains that sometimes the saintly or very religious person also has to meet with reversals in life. Such incidents should be taken as providential. Although there may be sufficient cause for being unhappy, one should avoid counteracting such reversals, for the more we become implicated in rectifying such reversals, the more we enter into the darkest regions of material anxiety. Lord Krishna has also advised us in this connection, we should tolerate things instead of becoming agitated. So, you know, he said that to Arjuna, Matrasva Sastra Kuntaya, Satoshinam Sukhatukada, Agama Apina Naitas, Tamsta Tiksasva Bharata. Arjuna was disturbed because, you know, in the battle of Kurukshetra, of course, I mean, at this stage, so many persons, you know, including his own son, may be killed in that battle. And naturally, you know, although Arjuna would understand it is his spirit soul, but still, if there's some, you know, seeing the conception of seeing the person, you know, in relationship to the body, it's going to cause some distress to see that person, that body destroyed, and the soul, you know, ripped out of that circumstance. So Krishna described to him that there is no other remedy except to tolerate it. That much you must tolerate. Arjuna was actually trying to rectify, you know, by he was saying, well, look, you know, I'll give up all my duties. You know, I'm supposed to be a chatru, a protector of right and wrong, you know, a leader of society, that's my duty, but I'll give up my duty and I'll just go and, you know, eat berries and fruits in the forest and, you know, not perform my duty. So, of course, that would have caused so many problems for Arjuna because, as Krishna pointed out, you're not really going to be able to do that because it's your very nature as a kshatriya. You know, how long are you going to live in the forest and just, you know, roam around, you know, like a pretend sannyasi? You know, you're a kshatriya. It's just not going to work. You have your nature. Then, you know, then you're going to be infamous for running from the battle. So then you've got that problem to deal with, and you know how many people that you know, and the sinful reaction of not doing your duty. You know, you're really just going to create a whole heap of problems, Arjuna. And in the long run, you'll end up, doing what I'm asking you to do anyway. You know, by your very nature, you'll end up fighting with Duryodhana, your kingdom. So. You know, really, he was just going to cause himself, he was trying to remedy it, the problems. There was something, there were things to be tolerated, you know, there were difficulties that Arjuna was going to face, and which he did end up facing. Krishna said, there's, you know, no other remedy, you're just going to have to tolerate that, but, you know, you can't remedy the inconveniences. Don't run around trying to remedy all the inconveniences in life. You do what you're supposed to do, you know. If you have a proper duty, a proper course of action that you're supposed to be doing, do that. Don't waste your time remedying, you know, all the inconveniences. That you just tolerate. So, you know, any questions on that?
Yeah.
Yes. We all do. And yeah, you're not alone.
And I'm wondering, is that like a sign of a reversal that I shouldn't be fighting against?
Okay, you know, there are several factors here, as we just, you know, hinted at with Arjuna, and here Preeti Maharaj. Preeti Maharaj, you know, does have a certain amount of activities that he should perform because he's the representative of the Supreme Lord, he's the king. There are certain things he must do. And here, one of the things that he wanted to do is to perform 100 horse sacrifices. Brahma's saying, whatever results you wanted from that, I'll give you anyway. So he no longer has to do it. Right? So it'd only be something he wanted to do, but doesn't really have to do it because the results have already been given. Therefore, he should just go about his normal duties. Right? And of course, that's the first point, is we should understand what our normal proper duties are. You know, so like if we're a mother, we've got to feed the children, we've got to make sure that they're educated, you know, and we're healthy. And, you know, so there are certain things, fundamental things, and we look after ourselves and our own body and our own health. There are certain fundamental things that we're supposed to be doing in life. Here, there was something he wanted to do, but, you know, then by Brahma's arrangement, he didn't have to do it anymore. He was going to get the results anyway. So then the question is that should he abandon the things that he should be doing and still try to remove this inconvenience that someone had stopped him from doing, you know, from doing the 100 yagyas. Right? So, you know, in that sense, better just tolerate the inconvenience. Better tolerate that some envious person is causing you so much trouble. In the long run, go about your normal duties. You know, you've got actually, you know, everything that you require is actually there anyway. So you know, it's like that. You know, so tolerate that. So it takes a little bit of common sense. In other words, we shouldn't take one of our fundamental duties, which we should do, as an inconvenience, and just don't do it and say, "I'll just tolerate it." You know. You know. You know, I was supposed to cook for the children. They're all screaming in the lounge room. I'll just tolerate the screaming. It's not like that, you see. So, you know, there are factors. You know, there are factors here. We have to understand what our proper duty is, our, you know, fundamental duty. We have to understand that, you know, there are you know, then there are inconveniences which by getting absorbed in counteracting those inconveniences, it takes us away from our fundamental duties, and in the long run the amount of endeavour and waste of time and anxiety, the result of what we're trying to achieve can be obtained in some other way. Right? Or it doesn't matter, or it may not matter too much if we forego that result sometimes. This is, you know, the story of the Brahmin's Copans. You know that story? The Brahmin's Copans, the play. So that, you know, the Brahmin was Brahmanas practice, you know, voluntary poverty. So he just had like a loincloth and a couple of pairs of copans. Copans, of course, they wrap around the waist and around the loins. And so he would wear one and wash the other set and just hang them up. And one day while he was chanting his mantras and what have you, a little mouse come along and started chewing on the copans that were drying. So you know, this is very inconvenient, you know. These are my possessions being, you know, chewed away, but so he thought what to do. So he thought maybe I'll get a cat, and we'll get a cat, and the cat will keep the mouse away. Someone, you know, manages to supply him a cat, and he's chanting his mantras, and in the background he hears meow, 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 and then the cat needs to be fed. So, you know, got to supply milk, and then he's thinking, this is difficult because I have to continually. So he thought, well, actually, if I get a cow, I'll have a continuous supply of milk. So he got himself a cow. And so the cow, you know, is giving the milk that the cat was keeping away the mouse, and then, you know, he's saying, moo, moo. And the cow needs to be milked, you know, every morning, every evening. He thought, maybe if I was married, you know, both my wife and I, we could share the duties. She gets to milk the cow sometime, and I chant my mantra. So, you know, he got married, and, you know, his wife was helping him in his various duties, and they were both, you know, chanting and milking the cow and what have you. And then, you know, his wife had become pregnant, she's going to have a little child, and, you know, she said, we're going to need a bigger, you know, living in a very small hut here, you know, so... He thought, so he went, you know, into the, you know, local Calcutta and, you know, borrowed some money to, you know, put an extension on his mud house and what have you. Anyway, you know, it just got complicated and complicated and complicated. And then, in the end, he thought to himself that I probably should have just tolerated the little mouse chewing on my coconuts. The difficulty of that tolerance is so minute compared to the remedy of putting into place. Right? So this is the instruction of Brahma. Be careful of that. When the remedy, your energy and anxiety to remedy something which is inconvenient is so, disproportionately greater than the little bit of tolerance to, you know, of that inconvenience, then you shouldn't do it. That's it. So it's not about, you know, using tolerance as a way of skipping duties that actually should be done or anything like that. It's that sort of point. So thanks for your comment. Any comments or questions?
You still have to do what you have to do. It's very individual.
So what happened was that the Brahmana from that point could never chant his mantras. He could never perform his usual daily practice of his, if he studied the scriptures, he would light a sacrificial fire, he would worship the Lord. He couldn't do that from that point on. He could no longer perform his duty. And he had to tolerate so much more than the little mouse. Yeah. So, you know, another story, you know, that Prabhupada tells that, you know, there was a Brahmana who was every day he'd go out and just whatever he would collect that day, he would, you know, that would be what he would, feed himself and his family. So, he went out one day and collecting alms, and, someone might ordinarily give him a japati or something like that, but on this day he couldn't get, anything sufficient to eat. There was nothing. And, but he was hungry. So, at the end of the day, there was just one person, who saw the Brahmana and, expressed, yes, I'm hungry. He says, yes, I can give you, some food, so come into my home. And so he sat him down and he put a little, bowl of, some soup or something, but, it had non-vegetarian food in there. So this Brahmana, he was so hungry, he ate it. So he literally gave up, his lifelong, fell down, great fall down from his, spiritual position. But that little bowl, he, after it, he was still just as hungry because it was only a little bit. And he said, you know, can I have seconds? Can I have some more? He said, well, sorry, that's all I have. So then he understood. So I've lost all my principles, and I'm still hungry. You know, so it's like that, you know, where what you're losing, what you're sacrificing, because you know, is far greater than what you need to tolerate. And in the long run, you end up having to tolerate the same thing plus a whole bunch of new problems. This is what Brahma is saying. This is what we have to be careful of. If we can distinguish like that, that is an art of going through life. If you can make that distinction, you know, here is a, you know, something to tolerate, and if I can't tolerate that, I'm going to end up with so much more problems that I'll have to tolerate so many things then that'll be in my life that I can't remove from my life, and I still have to tolerate the same thing that I set out to remedy in the first place. If you could make those distinctions, it's a very valuable lesson. That is the best remedy. That is the absolute best remedy. That's what Krishna says. You just tolerate that, Arjuna. That's the best to fix that problem.
That happens in family life all the time.
Yes.
Some family member that have caused some grief.
Yes.
And then if you don't tolerate them and you do these avoidance behaviours,
yes,
then it just over the years grows and grows and becomes a major problem.
That's right.
And so, basically, if you just put up with it to start with and just keep putting up with the minor insults or whatever they are, the grievances,
That's right.
Over a long period of time, you have less to do.
That's right, yeah.
And you can see in families, some members will, take offence and take these sort of actions toward that person.
Yeah.
And other people will just, turn a blind eye.
Yes.
And at the end of, say, 20 or 30 years, the person who's just kept going with their own thing has a much easier path.
That's right, So, you know, that's exactly right. You know, this philosophy, of course, it's not advocating that a person gives up their duties. It's not advocating that we tolerate abuses. But there is circumstances which are more common than not where just a little bit of tolerance is the best remedy than the process of remedying that, which actually literally brings in a whole bunch of problems and doesn't fix the original problem like that. Yeah. So it's not condoning any other things, but it is a remedy that can be used quite often. Marriage is a good, you know, in this day and age, marriage is a big one, where people just have to tolerate some difficulties that they're experiencing with the other partner, and by doing so, they save themselves a massive, because once the divorce process and, you know, the lawyers get in there and the relatives, and then even you get through that and, you know, your life has been turned upside down, then you've got the children who will make you pay, you know, for what you put them through in the separation for the rest of your life, you know.
And
you
get into another relationship.
That's right. And then the original problems follow you into your next relationship, and then you've got those children who've been through the same with their parents, and, you know, it just becomes a whole thing. And it can all be avoided by just, you know, a little tolerance like that. So,
So,
Nirmala is making a very very good point here, because, you know, as you said, there are factors here. You know, what is one's duty? What should be tolerated and avoided? What can be adjusted? It's better to adjust. You know, something is better to adjust. Here, Krishna asked Arjuna to tolerate, but then he also made him make some big adjustments to, you know, by fighting. Some things have to be adjusted, some things have to be tolerated. We have to perceive the difficulties that come from not tolerating what should be tolerated, and like that. So there are a lot of different factors. When one becomes, you know, studies these scriptures and puts it into practice over the course of one's devotional life, it becomes something that one can understand very easily. And not only put it into one's own life, but can advise others, you know. But these things can be quite complex in the beginning if we're just learning these things, and one should take guidance, you know, like that, because, you know, it's it's tricky. You know, a lot of, as we say, it's not advocating abuses, neglected duty, or things like that, and but it can be taken like that, so we have to be very careful. It should be done properly.
One really has to be careful, you know, even when it comes to discussing personal things with people, you know. Sometimes things like, you know,
There has to be expert guidance. There has to be, you know, you know, these are very advanced lessons. You can understand them in a second, you know. Putting them into practice, you know, is a whole different thing. That takes, you know, that takes. Putting them into practice, especially when a person may be confused in the situation they're in, you know, it's not such an easy thing. There's something that, you know, guidance is needed. So, Lord, there are many competitors in ordinary business affairs, and the Karmakanda chapters of the Vedas sometimes cause competition and envy amongst karmis. A karmi must be envious because he wishes to enjoy material pleasures to their fullest extent. We discussed that. That is the material disease. Consequently, there is always competition amongst karmis. Karmis are those who want to enjoy the fruits of their work. Either in ordinary business affairs or in the performance of yajna, Lord Brahma's purpose was to end the competition between Lord Indra and Maharaj Prithu. Because Maharaj Prithu was a great devotee and incarnation of God, he was requested to stop the sacrifices so that Indra might not further introduce irreligious systems, which are always followed by criminal minded people. Here, Prabhupada saying, you know, even in yajna, performance of yajna, or, you know, it means even in the, you know, worship of the Lord. One thing that always fascinates me is that, you know, when, you know, new devotees take Brahman or Brahmani initiation, because, you know, they're a sort of, in worshipping the deities, you know, there's a certain amount of prestige that one may get, you know, whether one likes it or not. You know, to be seen, you know, on the altar and touching the feet of the deities, and, like that. And sometimes, you know, amongst the devotees, you know, I've seen it, pujaris, you know, can become envious, you know, of one another. And you know, compete, you know, in an envious way. And but of course, you know, for one who's not part of that envious, competing mood, just, you know, trying to serve Krishna, then of course Krishna makes arrangements, you know, for his devotees. But yeah, it's there. We were discussing, you know, the other week about, you know, the amount, you know, facilities within the temple that, you know, devotees, you know, who are not, you know, who are, some material tinges, they can compete for facility, even amongst those who are, you know, been somewhat, you know, well situated for some time. Prabhupada, you know, he tells the story of, like, when Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakura, that's Prabhupada's, you know, spiritual master, when he began his movement, the Gaudiya Math, there was one of his, one person who became a disciple, but he literally, they sort of started it together. So that was Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's movement, and, you know, he was the leader of it, and it was really his spiritual inspiration and spiritual strength. The other devotee who became his disciple was very good at the management type of, you know. So, but when Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakura left the planet, that disciple considered that, well, we sort of started it together, the guru's gone, it's sort of really, you know, you know, it should really be mine, you know, there was some and then there was competition, you know, amongst, I mean, these are very, very senior devotees, they competed for, you know, proprietorship, rulership, you know, ownership, and they fought in the courts and literally destroyed the movement in doing so. So, you know, these things can come in, you know, at quite, you know, it's these material contaminations, they can manifest when circumstances, you know, we have to be always, you know, where humility is a great protective thing, because when we're humble, we understand that, you know, you know, we're a conditioned soul. We've been in the material for so long. We may have so much in our heart that we're even not so aware of. We shouldn't put ourselves up on too high a pedestal. You know, we've got so much purification to go before we really become, you know, a well-situated, advanced, you know, pure devotee. You know, so that keeping oneself in the humble mood, you know, of always trying to make advancement, always, you know, not seeing oneself as particularly advanced or, you know, particularly elevated, it is a protective mechanism which is very helpful. If we don't have that humility, which is not false but it's proper assessment of ourselves, we underestimate we overestimate our position and underestimate, you know, what's sitting there dormant within the heart, you know. And but Krishna knows and Maya knows. And the material energy can create certain situations that just stir up what's in the heart there and make it come out. Here, you know, you can imagine Indra, he's, you know, the king of heaven. I mean, he's, you know, he's actually a very elevated personality. You know, he's a very, you know, one of the most pious persons within the universe. Very elevated, very pious, very, you know, God-fearing person. But, you know, this Preetin Maharaj doing these yajnas stirred up something that was there, you know, that was in the heart. Certain circumstances will actually bring out what ordinarily may not show, you know, too obviously. So, you know, this was enough. So, you know, the point with Śrīla Bhaktisiddhānta Saraswati, the cause movement, of course, is that we shouldn't overestimate, you know, here we have a similar movement to what, you know, we shouldn't think that these things will never happen amongst devotees. You know, this is something that happens to Indra. You know, this is something that happens to the Kamis. You know, we're studying the Śrīmad Bhagavatam because we want to prevent it from happening to us. Or, if it's already happening, we want to be able to recognize it and to, you know, make the proper adjustments and what have you. That, you know. These are not remote things that happened millions of years ago. You know, it's an interesting reading. You know, this is what's happening to us, even within the temple, within someone else's temple, within, you know, politics, within, you know, family life. This is the material disease. Yeah. Any comments or questions on it?
So it's not so much a symptom of a lack in the process or a symptom of Kali Rupa's Indra as it's failing to even touch Yuga. It's more that the surge of through the material world, whatever planet, whatever earth realm or whatever Yuga we're in, where our heart is so contaminated.
Yeah. Because Krishna says that, you know, to take birth in this world, every living entity has to admit that they've got two contaminations.
Desire and hate.
If you're not contaminated by desire and hate, you will not take birth in this world. And that applies even to Brahma. But to speak of Indra. I mean, compared to Brahma, Indra is, you know, quite insignificant. So we have taken birth in this material world, so we have to understand that, you know, we have those problems and desire, you know, lust and envy, you know, desire and hate, you know, what a common thing that I even heard Prabhupada discussing this the other day in reference to the prayers of Queen Kunti, but he was saying that sometimes people begin chanting Hare Krishna and following the spiritual path, and all of a sudden there's so many disturbances, and they think, oh, what is happening? You know, I started chanting Hare Krishna and worshipping Krishna, all of a sudden, you know, there's so many disturbances like that, you know, within myself and within the body. So then they want to give up the process. But, you know, it is part of the purificatory process that it's not that something is all of a sudden happening that wasn't there before. It's that when we chant, when we take up spiritual life properly, those things which are in the heart, Krishna makes arrangements for us to see them. Those lessons that we need to learn, Krishna makes arrangements for us to learn those lessons. And what may take us hundreds and hundreds of lifetimes, Krishna may, you know, very expertly arrange in, you know, a few days sometimes, you know. And therefore, example is sometimes given of making ghee. That, you know, when you make ghee, you get the big block of butter that we used to do this. Of course, we never used to buy ghee, we used to make all our own ghee. And then you put it in the big pot and you'd put the oven on low, and then, you know, you come in the morning and all the butter salts have come to the top, and all the butter fats have come to the top. And so it's actually separated the pure ghee from the impurities. And then the process is to scoop the butter fats off the top, separate the pure ghee, and not remixing the butter salts which are in the bottom like that. But if someone is saying, well, you know, they're making the ghee and they're saying, oh, you know, we're supposed to be getting this pure ghee and all I see is all this froth and, you know, stuff coming to the top. What are you doing? You know, stop, stop. It's like that, you know. In spiritual life, these things are separated quite dramatically. That's the difference, you know. In material life, as long as we go on in material life, the pure spirit soul's qualities and the lust and the envy, you know, don't separate properly. You cannot distinguish between one and the other. As soon as you take our spiritual life, they separate quite dramatically. But then that gives you the ability to perceive the pure thing from the impure thing, and then to, you know, discard the impure thing and keep the pure thing. It's actually a natural part of the process, and the disturbances that manifest in our life are part of that separating process, you know, and the things that come up in the heart, you know, they get stirred up, they're for us to recognize what's in our heart, what's in someone else's heart, like that. Any questions or comments? Anyway, so Indra, just see how Indra, creating disturbance in the midst of the sacrifice by stealing the sacrificial horse, these attractive sinful activities he has introduced will be carried out by the people in general. So especially when someone who's a leader does something wrong, you know, it's whatever they do, others will follow. You know, that's always been something interesting to me, that, you know, a leader can daily, repeatedly point out and even in their own behaviour set examples of what should be done. It's very difficult to get someone to follow any of it. But if they do one little thing wrong, you can guarantee that everyone will follow that. You know, because that's the inclination, you know, of the souls, the conditioned souls, that they, you know, we have a tendency to want to do the mischievous thing. So as soon as they see a leader do that, this Jay, well, you know, so-and-so is doing it. You asked me to do this, but I don't, you know, I saw so-and-so doing it, you know, so, you know, don't go off of me. You know, so, you know, a leader can just, you know, constantly be doing the right thing, giving good instruction. It's very difficult for someone to follow any of it. They do one thing that's, you know, a bit questionable, and people are just, that's justification for me to do that. And I immediately follow. So therefore, you know, if people have a position of authority as a teacher, you know, so whether you're a yoga teacher or, you know, professional person or, you know, a leader amongst the devotees or, you know, a parent or, you know, anything, anyone in that leader position should, you know, be careful of that. An interesting thing here, in this purport to verse 36, Prabhupada says, people in Calcutta, there are many butcher shops which keep a deity of the goddess Kali. And animal eaters think it proper to purchase animal flesh from such shops in hope that they are eating the remnants of food offered to the goddess of Kali. So you've been to India, you see, yeah? So they do not know that the goddess Kali never accepts non-vegetarian food because she is the chaste wife of Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva is also a great Vaishnava and never eats non-vegetarian food, and the goddess of Kali accepts the remnants of food left by Lord Shiva. Right, so she eats the remnants of food of her husband, which, you know, all great personalities in this line do. He's completely vegetarian. There's no question of her eating non-vegetarian food. Therefore, there's no possibility of her eating flesh or fish. Such offerings are accepted by the associates of the goddess of Kali, known as Bhutas, Pisachas and Rakshasas. In other words, the ghosts and goblins and jinns and what have you. They're the ones who actually accept the offerings, and therefore the people are eating the remnants of ghosts and, you know, Bhutas and like that. It's a very dangerous practice. If you offer meat to the goddess of Kali, they think they're eating Kali Prasad. So they think they're eating Kali Prasad. Kali, they're eating the remnants of the goddess, but they're not. Yeah. That's right. So, there's a lot of foolish things going on, but everything is revealed here. So, Prithu, the son of Vaina, you are the part and parcel expansion of Lord Vishnu. Due to the mischievous activities of King Vaina, religious principles were almost lost. So that's the father he was born from. So at the opportune moment, you descended as the incarnation of Lord Vishnu. Indeed, for the protection of religious principles, you have appeared from the body of King Vaina. So he's a Shaktivesh avatar. So he's got quite a responsibility here, to preach service to the Supreme Lord as a great devotee of the Lord. O protector of the people in general, please consider the purpose of your being incarnated by Lord Vishnu. The irreligious principles created by Indra are but mothers of so many unwanted religions. So actually, what was created here, in this day and age, those religions that he created then, they flourish in this age of Kali. Please therefore stop these imitations immediately. This is the wonderful thing about the Bhagavatam, that you actually see the very beginning, of everything, good and bad, in this world. It's all described here. And understanding its beginning is very important. Just like Rahu and Ketu. Rahu and Ketu are discussed in the Bhagavatam because astrologically they're described as the north and south node of the moon, or sometimes the dragon's head and the dragon's tail. You heard of that? The nodes of the moon. So astrologically, even Western astrologers use them. They find it very, very difficult to understand, but they're used in Western and Eastern astrology. But the story of who was Rahu and the pastime is there, and if you understand that pastime as an astrologer, you can understand their influence in a person's life. And so it's very, very helpful. Everything is there, the Bhagavatam. So
well,
bring that question up next time. They're very easily refuted. So, King Prithu was thus advised by the Supreme Teacher, Lord Brahma. He abandoned his eagerness to perform yajñas and with great affection concluded a peace with King Indra. After this, Prithu Maharaj took his bath, which is customarily taken after the performance of a yajña, and that's called Avrabhrita bath. And received the benedictions and due blessings of the demigods, who were very pleased by his glorious activities. With great respect, the original King Prithu offered all kinds of rewards to the Brahmanas present at the sacrifice. Since all these Brahmanas were very much satisfied, they gave their heartfelt blessings to the king. All the great sages and Brahmanas said, O mighty king, by your invitation, all classes of living entities have attended this assembly. They have come from Pitraloka and the heavenly planets, and great sages as well as common men have attended this meeting. Now all of them are very much satisfied by your dealings and your charity towards them. So that ends that, that chapter. And next week we will hear Lord Vishnu's appearance in the sacrificial arena of Maharaj Prithu. So we'll hear about, you know, how Lord Vishnu appeared and what he did, what he said. Okay. Well, you know, for instance, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that that as the embodied soul passes from boyhood to youthhood to old age, similarly, the soul passes into another body at the time of death. Now, people can't say, well, everything has changed. That means that you say, well, you know, you had a little baby's body. Everyone that takes birth starts off with a little baby's body. So, you know, there's no question that anything has changed. And every that child always grows to the next stage of, you know, little girl, little boy. And they always get old and they always come to the next stage where they, you know, of death. So it's not... You can't say that applies to Hindus. You can't say it applies only to Christians or to atheists. You can't say it applies to, you know, 1,000 years ago. It doesn't apply now. It applies to everyone universally. So how can they argue? So then, you know, and that's the first point. That if they've said that, oh, everything has changed, then on that point you say, well, tell me which part of it has changed. You know, is there any part of that that has actually changed? You know, that will always be there. So then, if someone can't accept that that is always the same, then you really can't go on with that, the conversation with that person. If they're going to argue, like, you know the story of the scissors and the what's that story of the scissors and the knife? Who knows that one? It starts, you know, a crow landed on a branch or something, I always get this, and an apple fell or something. There's something, and someone said, you know, the apple fell and the crow landed, and at the same time someone was going to cut it or something. Someone said, no, it fell because you cut it with the scissors or something. There was something like that. So they got argued, you know. It was the scissors. No, it was the crow. It was the scissors, the crow. So he says, you say that one more time, I'm going to drag you in the river, I'll drown you, I'll kill you, you know. They got just so angry, you know. And he goes, yeah, it's the scissors, like that. So he grabs him by the scruff and then drags him in the river, holds him down like this, you know. And then he gets out of the river and he sees the guy coming up his last, you know, struggling. And then as he's going down in the water, he's like... You know, as he disappears under the water, like that, you know. It's like that. If you're dealing with someone like that, that till their dying breath, you know, they're going to argue ridiculously. Now it's all changed, you know, and it hasn't. You can't go on with if they understand, oh, okay, it hasn't changed, has it, really, you know, then you can discuss. That yes, this shows the movement of the soul, you know, so you can go to the next point. You know, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, all living entities subsist on food grains, you know, like humans in human society, you know, substantially they need food grains. You know, has that changed? That hasn't changed, you know, and food grains come from rain. Has that changed?
Let's make it very, very simple.
Well, It is very simple, you know. They're making it complicated by saying it's changed. Yeah, what's the difficulty? It's actually quite simple.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah.
I've been making that question.
Yes, go on.
Because in the purport of they said that Prithu Maharaj stopped being envious of Indra.
Yes, that's right. Yes, now go on. I got distracted by the cake, but go on, say it again, please. Has anyone got a knife just while we're answering this? Yes, we're going to have a little bit of cake here, please. Yeah. And some, is that, thank you, yeah. You've got some? Gee. Yes, go on. Stop being envious in the purport.
Yes.
To which verse?
I don't remember now.
But it's in those last.
It is there that Brahma says Prithu Maharaj stop being envious of Indra.
Right, yeah.
So I was surprised with that.
Yes. Yeah. That's a good point. In the purport, was it?
I think it's in the purport.
Can someone cut that and distribute that?
This word envy is used very loosely, isn't it? That's what it looks like. It's huge,
yeah. There'd be no need for us to be envious over who gets a big slice of cake, that's for sure.
It's huge.
That's a tremendous effort, isn't it? I'll see if I can find that for you.
I
can't find that yet. But still. In the Bhagavad Gita, I think it's the it might be the fifth chapter. There's one verse. Envy comes up that one should not be envious, and you know that's very pleasing to Krishna. A devotee who's free from envy. Prabhupada mentions that a devotee should not allow, when he's describing envy, he says a devotee should not allow another service to interfere with his own. In other words, someone may behave in an envious way towards us, and if we allow, if we try to curb that envy, rather than just, and that interferes with our normal service that we're doing or duties, in essence, we may be retaliating envy with envy.
Okay, so we are, so that envy is reciprocated. It's brought up in us,
yeah,
because we're trying to counteract.
Yes.
So, okay, how can you do this to
me? Yeah. So Prithu didn't become envious, but had he retaliated against Indra, even though Indra, and
how can he do it to me? So
yes, then it actually he would have also manifested envy. Yeah. So Prabhupada says that, you know, Krishna is very pleased with one who is non-envious, and how do we practically do that? It means don't let another person's service interfere with your own. They're doing a service in an envious way. As king, with, you know, I'm maintaining my kingdom. Maintaining, you know, I'm Indra, I've got to look after things. His service is affecting Prithu. He's saying, do not let another devotee's service affect your own. Yeah.
If he had taken that step, that means
he would have acted. Yes.
So how can he do this?
That's right. But he didn't, and therefore he wasn't.
So it's basically,
technically, what Ali would say, how dare you do it to me? Yes. That's taken as envy. Yeah, he would have been guilty of the same thing.
But it's still not envy.
No, it would have been envy. Yeah. If he had a retaliate, it would have been envy.
But at times you have to retaliate as well.
Yes, that's yes. But to distinguish that you're doing something out of envy and doing something to serve the Lord out of love is going to be two different things, and that's what we're gradually learning. There is a distinction. And we can't just say, sometimes in the name of serving God, we're actually doing something in envy. And we have to be able to distinguish. Yeah.
Can I please give you these details, though? This is my niece.
Okay, yeah.
The thing is whether she's, and at the time when she's choosing which career to go into.
Okay, yeah. All right.
Some sort of career like
that. Yeah. Okay.
Whether she'll go or not.
Can you write that for me? Write Nirmala's niece, and just put underneath career. Because sometimes I get home, I put a little bit of paper up and literally, you know, I think, where did that come from? Because you know, it's at the end of a lesson, you know, I'll probably. She knows I'm like that. You know, she asks me to do something, and if she catches me at the wrong time, she goes, "I told you." I think that I can't remember that. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Got me a little bit of fun.
Mm.
Oh, goodness. See, that's a nice coat.
Gunga, do you do astrology reading?
Yeah.
And how would I go about booking you in on?
Just follow what Nirmala is doing. Here's his
birth data.
Yeah, time, date. Time, date, and place. I tend to have a very busy lifestyle, but I do get around to it.
Pardon? I
do get around to it, yeah, but...
This is for me.
Nirmala knows it. You know, I try my best to sort of just see people as soon as possible, because I know that time goes past. So, if you want to have a look at that, I can do that, you know, and I will try and see you as soon as possible. Yeah? That's, yeah, look.
Do you have a...
I do. I used to run this as a business, and in the future, I'm actually getting a web page made up. You know, Manoj is going to make me a web page. You know? Yeah, he keeps pushing me. Manoj Kumar. He keeps pushing me that you should, you know, do this. Because usually I'm too busy, and I haven't done it as much. But I used to charge $175, and usually for devotees and people who, you know, I see regularly at the temple, I accept dakshina. And dakshina means that people offer, you know, a donation according to their capacity. But I tell them what my original fee is, just so that they appreciate the time and effort that I put into it.
All right. Should I leave my details?
You can, yeah. Yeah, if you know them, yeah.
The thing is, one of the problems is that
we would serve it. I'll serve you.
Thank you.
Should I write it down for you on a piece of paper?
Yes, paper is best for me. I did old fashioned. You know. Oh yeah, I usually spend. Until you understand it, you know, it can take a couple of hours. Because, you know, just, you know, usually when someone has no more questions on that subject, then
Is the name relevant? Like my
The first name is just something that put it in the computer. That doesn't affect the chart.
Okay, and is it different to the normal model of astrology? Because the Vedic astrology.
It's the Vedic astrology. Okay. Mm. And
is there a correlation?
Yes. Vedic astrology is the original astrology. The Western astrology is called tropical. It's based upon the precession of the equinoxes. You take the equator of the Earth out into, you know, the celestial equator out into space. At a certain point in time, they meet up at the first point of Aries on the opposite side of the zodiac, the celestial equator. But those equinoxes actually move. And it takes about 2,600 years to move one full 30 degrees, and after so many times it actually comes back to the original spot. So therefore the Western Zodiac is a moving Zodiac. So as perceived from, where we are on Earth at the time we're born, you know, we might say that Mars is in Aries, according to, you know, the Vedic zodiac is called Sidereal, I think the word is. It's based upon the planets being in that actual division of the stars where the constellation is at 30 degrees. So 30 degree constellation of Aries, Taurus, like that. So when a planet is in that constellation, as you see from where we are on Earth, at the time we look up in the sky and say, well, there's Mars in that 30 degree point in the sky. So there is a 24 degree roughly. I mean, there's an exact figure, but for our conversation, about 24 degrees difference in the two zodiacs. So, if you deduct that, what's called the iron arms, that difference from each planetary point and the ascending degree, you get the Vedic position. Or in other words, you can say if you actually take the proper position of the planets, and add 24 degrees, you get the Western. Because most computers calculate things according to, you know, for Western, therefore you go back a bit like that.
And what you mentioned before about the node, and you likened it to a dragon head and tail.
Yeah.
So the mythology behind the node.
Yeah,
and you can tell a lot by just the...
That's right, yes. The Rahu, Ketu.
Where they're going or where they've been?
You can understand what we look at in a chart is we look at, there's a party, come in, someone give him a party hat, he needs a party hat and a whistle. When we do a chart, I studied the Western Astrology at the New Zealand College of Astrology for about 3 years. If you go regularly each week, we had to do 90 charts just to pass the first of them. And I learned all the mathematics and everything, but I know what, and they were very good because they're very fundamental. In other words, a lot of the speculative things in Western Astrology they took out. Just what was fundamentally accepted, you know, which is very similar to the Vedic one, so there wasn't a lot of difference there. But in the Vedic astrology, there are things that you do that they don't do at all, they don't even know about.
Yes.
You look at the strength of each of the planets, or the weakness, and there's a numerical way to do that and all the various factors. So, you know, similar things that, the sun is exalted in Aries, and, you know, the moon is fallen in Scorpio, whatever like that. But there are many more factors like that, which are very fundamental. And then you get a numerical figure, and then you can see exactly, well, this planet is very powerful, this one is very weak. So, for instance, in the West, people say, watch your star, which means, where's your sun? So, by Western, where is yours?
Gemini.
What day were you born?
28.
28. 28. Of, where's the 28th of
May?
Of May. Yeah, okay, 28th of May. So, yeah. That means that by the Vedic one, that means your sun would be in Taurus. You know, because in the middle of each month, the sun changes according to the date of conception. By the Western ones, it's about the 21st and the 2nd. It's about the 15th or the 17th of the Vedic point, because that's when it hits the Vedic point of 0 degrees. From the about the 16th of May, the sun goes into Taurus. About 81, and then it'll stay there till about mid-June. And that means that if you're born, if you say 28, so there's about 12 days, so your sun would be about 12 degrees.
Taurus.
Okay,
so with the chart, do you look at general things like, what I'm interested in is vocation, and
yep.
Where I'm at a crossroads, but also I've got really strong things happening. What would you say?
Yep.
So do you mention?
Yep, once we understand that which planets are strong, which means that if a planet is strong, it can have two effects. It can have a strong harmful effect, or it have a strong beneficial effect. Some can be a mixture where they give a good effect in one area of life and a bad effect in another. So we look at how strong they are, whether they have a fully beneficial, fully harmful, or a mixed effect, and what area of life. So some planets particularly affect marriage, some affect children, some affect career, some affect your health. So, according to where they're situated, which houses they rule, you can see that they will affect certain areas of life. Right? If you're interested in a particular area of life, we can just look at those particular things. We can look at the chart as a whole, and then those things in particular answer those questions. But the other thing, which is very, very important, is that you can look at the timing. This is something, you know, which you don't really, you have to a very small degree in Western astrology. But each period of life is ruled by a particular planet. And then, so the planet. Yes. This planet kicks in, and this planet has a strong bearing on marriage, or career, or health, or what have you like that. It begins here, it goes to there, like that.
And what I shared today about the plant medicine
has
a very strong connection with
it.
That's good.
Yes.
And I want to know if I've got any sort of karmic damage from that.
Well,
I was not only participating, but I was helping facilitate. And when I ran into Julie, I had just come out, and it was interesting because I had asked the universe to send me some. I needed instruction. I asked for. I'm waiting for further instructions. I knew I was a turning point. And then I ran to Jolie again after a long time. I'm here. So I wonder, maybe when we sit down to talk about this, maybe we can see want to ask you if you have accumulated this bad energy for, like I said, 6 years. I've been working with some very strong energy.
Definitely. You can answer any questions from the astrologer.
Through the money.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right, that's fantastic. So, in your own time.
Yep. We've got a phone number, that's good. See ya. Any artists?
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. No, that's fine. Yeah.
That's all you need?
Yeah, that's good. All right.
Thanks, really all amazing today as well.
That's
so relevant.
Thank you.
Sorry,
Krishna. Krishna.
Come to your class.
That's right. Did you get here in time to get some tea? Oh, what is this?
Krishna Mataji's birthday today.
Ah, okay.
So he's, stuff. And Varuni Vani.